From WIPR, I'm Sheila Cast. We're on the record. True crime procedurals like the Netflix documentary Making a Murderer have shown a spotlight on the problem of wrongful convictions. How true to life are these stories? How hard is it to overturn a wrongful conviction? And what's it like to serve time for a crime you didn't commit?
It ain't a good feeling, I can tell you that.
We talked to a man who served 5 years for murder before he was exonerated, and to his lawyer about the hard road to proving your innocence once you're no longer presumed innocent. It's on the record after the news.
You're listening to On the Record, the podcast, a service of your public radio, 88.1 WYPR. Find more podcasts online at wypr.org. And tell us what you think. Send an email to ontherecord@wypr.org.
Good morning, I'm Sheila Cast. We're On the Record. Today we're talking about exoneration, that is, what it's like to serve time for a crime you did not commit and what it takes to overturn a wrongful conviction. At least 23 people have been exonerated in Maryland since 1989. One dramatic example, in May, Baltimorean Malcolm Bryant was released from prison after serving 17 years for a murder he did not commit. Bryant is one of many innocent defendants who have secured their release with the help of the University of Baltimore Innocence Project Clinic, an organization working with the Office of Public Defender that provides pro bono legal services to people convicted of a crime seeking to prove their innocence. The University of Baltimore will hold a conference tomorrow on wrongful convictions in Maryland. We have details at the On the Record page on WYPR.org. Criminal defense attorney Michelle Nethercott runs the UB Innocence Project Clinic, and she's with me in the studio. Welcome to On the Record.
Thank you.
In the conference tomorrow at UB, it's titled From Bloodsworth to Today, Wrongful Convictions in Maryland. Who is Bloodsworth?
Kirk Bloodsworth is a man who was actually the first person who had been sentenced to death and subsequently exonerated as a result of DNA testing. And because of that, his case garnered a lot of attention, not only locally, but throughout the country. Subsequent to his exoneration, the actual perpetrator was identified about a decade after the DNA testing that was done in his case. The profile that had been developed from the evidence was submitted to a national database, and the actual perpetrator of the crime was ultimately identified, subsequently convicted. Well, he entered a guilty plea, he was convicted, and he was sentenced to life. And so Bloodsworth was a very major event in Maryland. It influenced much of the debate about the death penalty in Maryland. And we're closing in on about 25 years from the time of the Bloodsworth case. And so what we're hoping to do in this symposium is to basically examine what has happened in Maryland in those two decades since the exoneration of Kirk Bloodsworth.
Almost 25 years. How has the process changed in Maryland in those decades?
Since the time that Bloodsworth was exonerated, there have been a lot of changes that have been initiated by the Maryland legislature, both to provide avenues for those who have been convicted of crimes they didn't commit to try and demonstrate that to a court and ultimately secure an exoneration. For example, in 2001, the Maryland legislature passed a post-conviction DNA testing act. Prior to that, there really was no mechanism for obtaining evidence, physical evidence to test, nor was there any provision if you could secure the evidence and test it and show that it ratified your claim that you hadn't committed the crime, that you could do anything about overturning the conviction. So that was one of the earliest responses.
Was evidence even kept in those days?
If it was, it was at the election of the police or prosecutor. There was no mandate to do that. And in fact, when the legislation was enacted in 2001, it did not initially contain a mandate for preservation of evidence. Now, the statute's been amended 5 times since then. One of those amendments does require law enforcement to retain evidence for the length of time that the person who was convicted in connection with the case remains incarcerated. That's not for all crimes. That's only for certain categories of crimes like murder and rape. There is an evidence preservation requirement.
Some listeners, when they hear that at least 23 people have been exonerated in Maryland since the late 80s, might think it's not that hard. There's a process, and it, apparently it's possible to go back and double-check things. How hard is it?
It's very difficult. That may not seem like a very large number. And, of course, you have to bear in mind that number represents those exonerations that have been documented by an organization called the National Registry of Exonerations. So those are the exonerations that have come to the attention of that registry. They've then gone out and vetted all the information to make sure that what, you know, has been presented to them is accurate. They only know about it if someone notifies them. So those are the ones that we know about, that someone hasn't actually been able to pull up the court records, look at the case, and verify everything. Really, it's an incredibly difficult thing to do to overturn. Well, for understandable reasons, there's an enormous reluctance on the part of courts to overturn convictions, particularly in serious crimes. And that's related to this notion in our legal system of finality that sometimes expressed as the trial is the main event and everything that is supposed to bear on the fact-finding is supposed to happen at the trial. Now, after that, the person, first of all, they no longer have a presumption of innocence, and there is a presumption in favor of upholding the conviction. So you have to have very powerful evidence that changes the factual picture that was presented to the original fact finder.
So essentially it needs to be some kind of new evidence.
In essence, yes. And even then, there are a lot of procedural obstacles to presenting that evidence. When you hear the term newly discovered evidence, it's not quite what it might sound like, because newly discovered evidence has a very specific legal meaning. If there's a credible argument that the defendant's attorney should have uncovered this evidence in some fashion, you can't present it. You're procedurally barred from doing so. It's also just very difficult to, much of the evidence that emerges that supports a person's claim they didn't commit the crime is often not easy to obtain. You know, there are various reasons that information that should have been present at trial didn't get presented at trial. And if it's related to something that should have been disclosed that wasn't, or it was something that the defense attorney should have uncovered but didn't, you really have to go back and go through investigative files. It's not easy. Sometimes people don't keep the files. Sometimes the lawyers don't have the files. Investigative files typically have to be accessed through a Public Information Act request, which means you don't just get the file. You get a redacted version of it. Sometimes you have to actually initiate civil litigation just to even get access. So it's not easy to get the evidence in the first place. And then if you succeed in getting it, of course, you have to be able to tie it to some kind of viable legal claim. And so for all of those reasons, it's very difficult.
This is On the Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cass speaking with Michelle Nethercott, criminal justice attorney who runs the University of Baltimore Innocence Project Clinic. You know, Michelle, wrongful convictions make for such dramatic storytelling. The Netflix documentary Making a Murderer tells the story of a man exonerated from murder. And season one of the Serial podcast was about a Baltimore teen convicted of murder in 2000. That has led to a new trial. What role does media tend to play in exonerations?
Well, I think your very question there probably answers itself. It plays quite a large role. And in fact, it was really the media that profiled a number of these wrongful conviction cases going back decades ago. In Chicago, for example, the media uncovered so many instances of people who had been sentenced to death who turned out to have not committed the crimes. And finally, Governor Ryan, who was a Republican conservative governor, when he realized that as many people as had been executed had been exonerated, he initiated a moratorium on the death penalty in Illinois. So the media was very much instrumental in bringing to light this problem. Going back 20 years ago, when I say the media, we're typically talking about print media. Today we have a somewhat different phenomenon. We have the podcast. But again, I think as you see, the attention that was focused on those two cases has led to results for the defendant that I suspect, had there not been that kind of media focus, probably would not have occurred. In some ways, that's a bit troubling because I'm not sure that people's efforts to be exonerated should be a function of whether they're the subject of a podcast.
I want to pull somebody else into this conversation. Demetrius Smith is with us here in the studio. He served 5 years in prison for a murder he didn't commit. He was released in 2013 with the help of the UB Innocence Project Clinic. Demetrius Smith, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for inviting me.
So, Demetrius, you were convicted in the death of a man named Robert Long, a man you didn't know, on the strength of faulty eyewitness accounts. Tell us what happened.
Well, I had one person that I didn't even know make up a story and said they seen me do something. Then I had a person that I did know, which wasn't of good character, lie and said that they did see me, that they knew me do this. Their stories was different, but it was still two people. That's all you need is two witnesses to say that they seen you do something, whether their story the same or not.
And so what was your sentence?
Life plus 18 years.
So what was it like to serve time knowing that you were innocent?
It ain't a good feeling, I can tell you that. Because I felt as though the justice system failed me.
Did you have any hope that you'd get out?
Somewhat, because it's guys in there now that I left in there that's locked up for things they didn't do, that's still fighting, been locked up for 20 years, 30 years, trying to get home on crimes they didn't commit.
So how did you get in touch with the Innocent Project Clinic?
I had got the attorney. She got in touch with Michelle and advised my sister and them to get in touch with her too.
So tell me about that part of the process, Michelle. I mean, how is Demetrius's story about a lawyer telling him to get in touch with you, is that how you tend to get in touch with the clients you work with?
Not really. In the vast majority of instances, people will write to me. We're really not equipped to do intake by telephone, because if I did intake by telephone, I would just be on the telephone 24 hours a day.
How many prisoners do you hear from in a given month or a given year?
In a given year, probably averages about 350.
So, like one a day?
Oh, at least, yes. Mm-hmm.
How do you sort them through?
Oh, well, in some ways, that's the most difficult part of this work. The screening process that I use is very lengthy. The person is asked to fill out a standard form questionnaire that asks them a series of questions. Sometimes in the course of completing that, it becomes apparent that they're not innocent. So, for example, a lot of people think that, you know, if they're not the person who actually killed someone, they just drove the getaway car, you know, that they're innocent. Well, they're not. So sometimes the answers to the questions tell me at that point that there's no need to go any further. If they get through that first screening process, then it becomes a process of acquiring documents, court documents, transcripts, investigative reports, talking to the attorneys that previously handled the case at trial or on appeal. And sometimes it involves actually going out and doing subsequent investigation, trying to locate witnesses, interview witnesses. Sometimes if there's some kind of scientific issue involved, it requires consulting with experts. Or if there's a question of DNA testing, then it's, a question of moving forward with trying to get the evidence released for testing. But it's a very long, long process, very frustrating to people, because it typically takes years.
That is Michelle Nethercott, a criminal defense attorney who runs the University of Baltimore Innocence Project Clinic here on the Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast. Also here with us is Demetrius Smith, who was exonerated after spending 5 years in prison for a murder he did not commit. I want to pick up on something that Demetrius told us about. It was witnesses. It was two witnesses with a different story, he says. But it was basically witnesses who had the story wrong,
right,
that led to his conviction. Is that common, and how do you address that in trying to get an exoneration?
Certainly in cases where the wrong person gets convicted, it's not uncommon at all that witnesses testified to something that was inaccurate. Sometimes it's inaccurate through really no fault of the witness. I mean, the most glaring example of that is mistaken eyewitness identification. People just, they make a mistake. They're absolutely sincere. They believe that they saw this person, but they're just wrong. And all the things we've learned in the last 20 or 30 years about eyewitness identification tells us that it is an inherently, potentially very unreliable kind of evidence. In Demetrius's case, it was a little different because these two individuals who testified against him, well, one of them ultimately subsequently acknowledged that she had lied on the stand. The other individual is actually deceased, but clearly he was not being truthful.
Demetrius Smith, tell us about the moment when you found out that you had been exonerated.
I thought I was dreaming, because when you're in there fighting to get back out, it's a chance you may not make it. Because like I told you, it's guys in there that's been locked up for 20 and 30 years that's innocent, that ain't home yet. So I guess it was a blessing that I came home as quick as I did.
How soon after you learned that you had been exonerated, were you free?
About a year later.
That's very fast.
Is that fast?
That's extremely fast. I mean, I'm sure it doesn't feel like that to Demetrius, but typically these cases go on for years, years and years and years. So it was a very quick exoneration.
What has it been like to go back to life on the outside?
It's been a little hard because when you go get a good job, you get hired, they got to run your record. And these things pop up on you.
So this murder conviction is still on your record?
Everything is still there. It still pop up. The employer still can see everything. It's on the internet.
Michelle Nethercott, is that typical?
Yes. Anybody can go online now and go to a court website and search someone's name. If they've had a charge filed against them, it's typically going to appear.
Has this conviction been expunged?
No.
Can it be?
Well, that's a process. You have to apply. You have to file a motion for expungement. If it's filed within a certain period of time, you have to sign a waiver saying that you will not initiate any sort of civil action against anyone who you allege did something wrong that resulted in the wrongful conviction. The state has an opportunity to respond to the petition for the expungement, and then ultimately a judge has to rule on it. But it's not automatic by any stretch.
Demetrius Smith, so it's been hard to find a job.
Yep, a good job, yep. And it's hard to get housing. Like, you got to use somebody else's name to get you an apartment or something, because even they do criminal background checks now. They're getting to an apartment or a house. And if you got that on your record, they ain't letting you in there.
What has your conviction and your exoneration meant for your relationship with your family?
It's good. I'm happy. I'm home. They happy. So it's pretty good.
I'm so grateful to you for talking to us. And congratulations, I guess.
Thank you. Yeah, you can say that.
And Michelle, thank you, too, for
talking
to us. Criminal defense attorney Michelle Nethercott runs the University of Baltimore Innocence Project Clinic, a collaboration with the Office of the Public Defender. Demetrius Smith is a former client of the clinic. He was released from prison in 2013 after serving 5 years for a murder he didn't commit. He says he hasn't received an apology. Tomorrow, the University of Baltimore is hosting a conference about wrongful convictions. It is free and open to the public. We have details on our page at WYPR.org. I'm Sheila Cast, and this is On the Record. I'm glad you're listening, and because you're listening, I hope you'll consider backing that up with a pledge of financial support for WYPR. Here's Nathan Sterner.